that impact all of us here in Santa Cruz. 427-3772 is the phone number to call in. I've got a kind of a couple of brief things I wanted to do here. I was reading in the past from a booklet I got in the mail by Harvey Weisong called The Jury's Business is Justice, a Reinvestigation of the Jury, printed November 2003 up in Helena, Montana by the Fully Informed Jury Association. You familiar with them jury nullification folks, Yon?
Yes, I am.
And I began to read from this. I talked about how, I read a little part about how lawyer nullification is perfectly okay, but jury nullification is something that apparently is frowned upon. I'm going to read a little bit from this, and I'm going to repeat that section I read on lawyer nullification because I think it's interesting. Isn't it funny that government agents and lawyers, our government agents, are unwilling to trust the judgment of 12 good citizens on matters of law? They dislike the idea of jury nullification. Again, jury nullification, those who don't know, is when the jury says no, not guilty, to a judge, a prosecutor that wants to convict someone of something. And when this is done in, let's say, even though the facts might lead someone to think that an individual is technically guilty of violating a law, let's say marijuana law, prohibition law, law for against escaped slaves, law about, protest against an illegal war, where the letter of the law might say, oh, send this person to jail, the jury just says not guilty and ignores the fact that the law is technically being violated. And ignores the fact that the judge almost invariably says you have to follow the law even if you don't agree with it. To some people, this is sort of a crazy, chaotic, wild, and unmanageable situation that when they first hear about it. But in fact, to others, like the Fully Informed Jury Association, this is the jury is really the fourth branch of government and the branch of government that's actually most accessible to us. You can't influence what they do in Sacramento or Washington, really. I mean, you can try, get out there and do a lot of lobbying and marching, and maybe you will if you've got tens of thousands of people with you. And you try to go to city council, unless you've got contacts, they're going to kind of ignore you. That's the legislative branch. The judges, you got to get into court, and you got to pay a lot of money, get a lawyer, put a lot of time. That's expensive. And as for the executive, unless you've got friends in the governor's office or friends in the, you know, the president, or, you know, your pals are in the sheriff's department, you're not going to get very far there either unless you have the right connections. But you can appeal to a jury if the jury knows that they have the right to say not guilty. When the city and the county are engaging in systematic enforcement of unconstitutional laws, such as, in my mind, drug prohibition laws, which are laws that in essence have nothing to do with real health and safety in the state, but are simply a massive incursion and a boondoggle that allows the, you know, huge amounts of forfeiture money to go to the police department, which it corrupts the judiciary, and it corrupts the executive, it corrupts all the branches of government, and it corrupts the police departments most directly. Then you can, the jury, even one juror can say not guilty, and that will require a new trial. If all 12 say not guilty, there ain't going to be no new trial. It's going to be thrown out. And if enough people say that, then the prosecution is going to have to stop trying to try those kinds of cases. So I'm going to read a little bit more about this. That's jury nullification. They dislike the idea of jury nullification. They want the jury bound by the dictates of the legislature. These are lawyers, government agents. And yet you don't hear a peep out of them when a certain lawyer makes a decision to nullify the law, when that lawyer decides to ignore the law or determine for himself what the spirit of the law is. But that's exactly what happens when the prosecutor decides not to prosecute a case in which the law has been violated, when the prosecutor accepts a guilty plea to lesser charges, when the prosecutor drops some charges in exchange for a guilty plea on another charge, when a prosecutor thinks a prosecution would be a misapplication of the law, and on and on. Oh, it's okay for a lawyer to make such a decision by herself or by himself, but it's not okay for 12 good citizens to make the same decision. When lawyers are the most despised class in our society, how can we accept the judgment of one lawyer in preference to the collective wisdom of 12 good citizens? Somehow, it just doesn't add up. A record of achievement. It was a jury of 12 ordinary men who struck the decisive blow for religious liberty. In London in the year 1670, William Penn was on trial for his life for having preached the Quaker gospel in violation of the Conventicle Act. it was a capital offense to preach any religion other than that of the Church of England. Penn stated to the jurors that the king had no right to interfere in man's relationship with God. He insisted that they must acquit him. The chief judge, however, told the jurors that since Penn had admitted the law and admitted that he preached in violation of it, they had no choice but to find him guilty. Despite 2 days of intimidation by the court, the jurors held to their verdict of not guilty. The court bitterly accepted the verdict, but fined the jurors for going against the good advice of the court. These two trials are the subject of a historical novel, The Trial of Edward Bushell, by Godfrey Lehman. Interesting book. I suggest you recommend you try to get it from the library, L-E-H-M-A-N, Godfrey Lehman, a San Francisco writer. In the appeals that followed, the jurors' fines were found to be unlawful. Thus ended one of the most important jury trials in history. From these controversies we derive several vital fundamentals of law. 1. Freedom of religion. 2. Right of peaceful assembly. 3. The right of the jurors to render their verdict without fear of punishment. 4. Freedom of speech. And 5. The right of the jury to acquit the defendant regardless of the law and of the evidence. Freedom of the press. John Peter Zenger had made a nuisance of himself. He published a newspaper in which he told the truth about corruption in government, especially the rampant corruption in the governor's office. To silence Zenger, the colony of New York passed a law requiring newspapers to obtain licenses from the government. But Zenger continued to publish without one. So, in 1735, in the colony of New York, John Peter Zenger was tried for publishing an illegal newspaper. Attorney Andrew Hamilton, not related to Alexander Hamilton, asked the jury to nullify the law and declare Zenger not guilty. They did, and that verdict secured our right of freedom of the press. Slavery. From the case of Jenny Slew in 1766 to the case of Quack Walker in 1783, Massachusetts juries returned verdicts declaring about 20 slaves to be free men and women. With the Walker verdict, slavery was forever eradicated in Massachusetts. This happened before the legislature, before the judiciary, before the Civil War, before any of that. In the 1850s, juries throughout the non-slave states refused to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act and Article 4, Section 3, Paragraph 2 of the U.S. Constitution. The juries nullified both federal laws and the U.S. Constitution. That's a section, I believe, the Constitution that allows for return of fugitive slaves. In the late 1800s, juries protected the rights of laborers to organize unions despite state laws which made it illegal. And in the 1920s and 30s, juries frequently acquitted people who had violated the prohibition laws. As a consequence of these no-confidence votes, the 18th Amendment, which had authorized prohibition, was repealed by the 21st Amendment in 1933. You might be wondering what other circumstances might compel a jury to find the defendant not guilty despite the facts in the law. Let's look at a few examples. Is the punishment too severe for the crime? In many cases today, especially drug cases, there are mandatory minimum sentences. If the defendant is found guilty, he is automatically sentenced to life without chance of parole or 20 years or more. If the juror feels that the punishment is too harsh for the severity of the crime, he should vote not guilty. Government has learned the hard way that juries will acquit defendants if the punishment is too severe. Therefore, government officials passed rules and regulations prohibiting the defense attorney from addressing this issue to the jury. In federal and most state cases, the jury cannot be informed of the punishment the defendant will suffer upon conviction. But the jury has a remedy. If they inquire about the sentence and the court refuses to inform them, the jury can simply play its trump card, not guilty. Henry VIII manufactured almost 200 petty regulations which he enforced as felonies with hanging. One of those laws was against begging, according to Charles Adams of the book For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. Is the law obscure? We frequently hear the glib phrase that ignorance of the law is no excuse. But does that make sense? Does that mean that the legislature and executive branches could pass a secret law that we would be bound to obey that law and that a jury would be bound to enforce that law? No. That offends our sensibilities. We cannot be bound to obey a law of which we have not been given notice. But in the United States, over 15,000 new laws are passed each year. Is there any difference between passing 15,000 laws per year and passing laws in secret? No one can possibly know what his legal obligations are when there are 15,000 new laws each and every year. The more corrupt the state, the more numerous the laws, according to Tacitus, a Roman historian, lived from 55 AD to 117. That phrase, ignorance of the law is no excuse, might have made sense hundreds of years ago when the law confined itself to real crimes with real victims. I don't know about this particular, I don't know if I agree entirely with this. A lot of bad laws then, too. Everyone knew that murder, rape, theft, and arson were crimes. No sensible person would accept the argument that the defendant was ignorant of the criminal nature of those acts. Today, that phrase is used to hold each of us accountable for tens of thousands of laws which protect government authority, not people. It is time to abandon this Orwellian maxim and demand that our laws be governed by reason. Ignorance of the law is an excuse if the jury says it is. Can the law be understood by the average citizen? Let us assume that government did agree to abandon its present practice of passing tens of thousands of laws and publishing them in law books that the public never sees. Assume that they agree to publish all new laws in your local newspaper, but they print the laws in Latin or Swahili. Would that constitute proper notice? I think not. The average citizen cannot understand them, but are Latin and Swahili any more difficult to understand now than the legalese which is now employed? Not by much. In 1992, the Georgia legislature passed a law, Senate Bill 159, which they said would make it a felony for an optometrist to perform eye surgery with a laser instrument, because optometrists are not medical doctors. Many legal authorities claim that the law made it a felony for anyone but a medical doctor to administer a hypodermic injection. Upon review, the state Supreme Court declared the law unconstitutional for reason of vagueness. It seems that even $200,000 per year lawyers have trouble understanding legalese. In truth, it's very difficult to write a law that does what its authors intend. Without the jury's common sense review, some of these laws become misguided missiles the instant they are launched. This view was eloquently stated by Judge David Bazelon of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The drafters of legal rules cannot anticipate and take account of every case where a defendant's conduct is unlawful but not blameworthy, any more than they can draw a bold line to mark the boundary between an accident and negligence. It is the jury, a spokesman for the community's sense of values, that must explore that subtle and elusive boundary. That's from Bazelon's opinion in U.S. versus Daugherty, 1972. Is the government exceeding its authority, violating the Constitution, violating common decency? Judge Weissman observed, judicial and prosecutorial misconduct still occur, and Congress is not yet an infallible body incapable of making tyrannical laws. When you sit on the jury, it is your obligation to enforce only those laws that are constitutional. How on earth will you know if you haven't studied the Constitution? The court will not provide you a copy as you deliberate in the jury room. If you don't know the Constitution or have a copy in your pocket, you won't get the answers in the jury room. Does the law say what the judge says it says? There either is or is not a law forbidding a certain conduct or requiring a certain conduct. The jurors do not know unless they are given a copy of the law to read. If the jury cannot understand the law, how can the defendant be required to understand and obey the law? If the judge refuses to provide a copy of the law as evidence of its existence, the jury should assume that no such law exists and simply vote not guilty. When the crime in question is rape, robbery, murder, arson, battery, or the like, it is not necessary to read the law. These acts are crimes, whether the law is written or not. Is the law being selectively enforced? There is no effective difference between a law that discriminates against a group or class of people and law enforcement that does the same thing. If the jurors see evidence of this, they have the right to vote not guilty. Is this a case of double jeopardy? In some cases, a person who has been acquitted by a state jury will be indicted and retried by the federal government. The Fifth Amendment forbids that the government try a person twice for the same crime. Giving the crime two different names does not change the reality that the defendant is being tried twice for the same alleged act. Has the judge refused to allow the jury to review some of the testimony in the case? In cases which drag on for weeks or months, the jury may ask to have the court reporter read back some of the testimony in the trial. Remember now, the standard for conviction in criminal trials is beyond a reasonable doubt. If the jury is asked to review some of the testimony, it is because they are uncertain what that testimony was and think the testimony is important. If the jury is prevented from reviewing such testimony, they cannot be certain of the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and must in good conscience vote to acquit. Did the defendant intend to commit a crime? Both the civil law of Rome and the common law of England acknowledged that a person could not commit a crime unless his intent was criminal. That principle exists in our law as well. That is one reason why people who are truly insane cannot commit a crime. They lack the capacity for criminal intent. Let's look at another example. If a missile technician accidentally launches a nuclear missile that hits New York City, killing millions, has he committed a crime? No, there was no criminal intent. He may be liable for some real stiff damage suits, but he is not a criminal. It is the jury's job to determine intent. If they find none, the defendant is not a criminal. Was there a victim? Was the only party injured the government? The only real crimes are those with real victims. The others are simply regulations imposed by government to exert more authority over its citizens. Should someone go to jail for violating regulations? If you are on the jury, you will be able to send a message to government officials about victimless, quote, crimes. True crimes are evil at all times and all places. Murder, rape, theft, arson, and battery are examples. Manufactured crimes depend on the time and place. Take, for example, the government's elastic view on gold and whiskey. After the 18th Amendment prohibition passed, a man walking down the street with some gold coins in one hand and a bottle of whiskey in the other could be arrested for the possession of whiskey. Then in 1933, prohibition was repealed and the private ownership of gold was made illegal. The same pedestrian could then carry the bottle of whiskey without fear but be arrested for possession of the gold coins. Does the law or the enforcement of it violate the Fourth Amendment? And the Fourth Amendment reads, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, I don't agree with all this, every single thing that's written here by Harvey Weisong, but I think it's really important, if you get on a jury, that you understand you make the decision as to what's going to be happening with the defendant. You decide whether what she or he is doing is criminal behavior. You decide whether the prosecution is acting fairly, whether the law is a constitutional one, whether the sentencing for this law, which I'll try to conceal from you, is something that you really want to subject an individual to, whether you think that the interests of the community will be served by doing that. That's your responsibility, regardless of how much the judge tries to take it off your shoulders by saying, look, just fill in the dots, add up the numbers, and you can go home. No. It's a human life and human liberty at stake, and you have to be aware of that. Every day, people are losing their liberty in the war on drugs, and the war on, quote, terror is another aspect to this, which we don't have time to go into, but, well, there's been a lot of talk about it in the last couple of years, and properly so. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert, and thank you for informing us. Let me turn off my radio.
Sure.
Thank you for, you know, putting out the information on jury nullification, and I just had one thing I wanted to add to that.
Uh-huh.
That is, you know, if you intend to, you know, if you're on a jury, if you're lucky enough to get chosen, and a lot of us aren't, you really can't reveal that you know this information. You have to, you know, if you decide you want to be a juror and go forward, you cannot talk about this information at all, or you will not be chosen as a juror. And if you are chosen as a juror and bring this discussion into the jury room, there's a good chance you will be pulled off the jury and replaced with an extra. And it's just, you know, I wish it weren't that way, but there's still a struggle to get the courts to recognize that this is legitimate. This is actually constitutional-based rights as a juror.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody, you know, who's aware of their rights as a juror is on the jury, the best thing to do is just keep it to yourself. But when it comes time to vote, just say, well, I'm not convinced that this person is guilty, and you know, hang up the jury with your, you know, with your refusal to convict, and you will have accomplished the same thing. But they have ways of getting you off the jury if you reveal that you know this ahead of time.
I hear you. I mean, they even have ways of harassing people who are distributing jury nullification literature around the courthouse.
Right, right.
Although I've done that, and I feel it's a First Amendment protected activity. It's a risky business.
You got to be willing to take it the next step if you're going to do that. But also, if you're going to share information, you need to not target jurors. You just, you know, hand it out to everybody and don't ask them if they're a juror. Just, you know, you're out there educating the public. But you know. Again, don't reveal that you know it, because you'll have a chance to actually use the knowledge then and hopefully be effective in keeping somebody who shouldn't be in jail out of jail.
Right. Well, listen, thank you, Theodora.
Hey, thank you.
We'll talk more about other issues. I know you've been covering the medical marijuana scene, too, and the broader drug prohibition war. So we'll talk more about that.
Okay. Well, you happy New Year, and thank you for, again, being, keeping us aware of the newsmakers out there that are, affecting our community.
We've got to add some women newsmakers. Just had two.
Oh, I noticed that.
I want you to name a few newsmakers while you're with us. Anyone you want to mention?
Well, Sherry Conable. I don't know if she was mentioned yet.
She was not.
She should be. She's been very active in various Bill of Rights issues and, the peace efforts. And she's, she's somebody who is able to bridge, because of her political work in other arenas, actually has one foot in the homeless community and one foot in the politically recognized community. So she's a wonderful asset in this community, because she really is not playing the same games that those considered politically credible are willing to play.
Any other women of unrecognized merit that you want to mention?
About
Theodora Carey.
Well, I have put my time in, but certainly not this year. I'm drawing a blank.
Well, you think about it, and then on the next show, we expect at least 10 names, okay?
I don't do homework anymore.
Uh-oh.
Okay, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that's it for the Bathurst Spears Broadsides show today. Hope you enjoyed it. We're coming back on Thursday at 6 here in the evening. Huff will meet Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom at 8:30 in the morning at Baker's Square. And we will, that'll be the last day of the year, and who knows, maybe we'll have some antics planned for a first night. First night, as you may not know, is going to be mostly indoors. Apparently they got tired of seeing all the police marching up and down the street, and they want to clear away the crowds and just, have a sort of a more genteel bourgeois affair. I'd like to see it as a general community celebration, and maybe we can do some stuff on the streets as well, but we'll see what happens. Pretty cold out there. We're also going to be talking about latest reports from Paul Brindell about the massive upsurge in demands for emergency shelter that we can be pretty damn sure are not being met in any significant or consistent way. And we're going to be covering Sacramento in the Billy McManus case, the guy who's been arrested for camping and fought successfully in the courts using the necessity defense. And we're going to be talking more about that and other, all kinds of things. So come on back on Thursday, and we'll do some of that. Skidmark, anything you've got you want to say? Skidmark's coming on with some music after all this babble, but maybe you have an update of some sort?
No, but you got a phone call.
I do have a phone call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah. I heard that the Peace Friday people have something planned for first night.
Oh.
And I thought Susan Zeman might also make the list for newsmakers with her Peace Fridays
That's
event.
Every Friday at Ocean and Water Streets, she's been out there reminding people that, yes, people are getting shot down by your soldiers over there in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And your soldiers are also getting shot down, and people who are not getting shot down are the ones who are sending them over. What am I saying? We don't want them to get shot down. We want them to get removed from office, right?
I have her email here. She says, some of you might remember last year, we're talking about first night now, with the sort of ad hoc coalition of progressive groups and individuals marching together. We received a wonderfully warm reception from the crowd, but the interactions with the event organizers weren't so warm and fuzzy. We failed to follow their no signs or banners rule and completely ignored their pleas for no political messages.
Oh, dear. Well, we don't want any political messages to sully the New Year's celebration, do we?
That's apparently what the organizers of First Night don't want. No signs, no banners, no political messages. Susan Zeman's got something up her sleeve. She wants people to come with green pants and red shirts for some reason.
Green pants and red shirts. This is at what time and where?
Let's see. There's some sort of an organizing meeting on Monday, December 29th at 6:30 p.m. And that's at the El Rio Mobile Home Park in downtown Santa Cruz. So
Oh, really? Okay.
People can get go there and plan what they're doing.
Where in the El Rio Mobile Home Park?
It's I guess it's a community center. Somewhere in the middle, probably.
Okay.
The Rec Hall at the El Rio Mobile Home Park.
Okay.
And what else does she say here? She says that they have a Wizard of Oz theme going with the whole first night. And so they're planning some sort of skit that's in keeping with that somehow.
Okay, so this is going to be the 29th at the Rio Mobile Home Park's community room at what time?
6:30 p.m.
6:30 p.m.
Organizing meeting.
That's
Susan
tomorrow,
Zeman,
right?
From the Santa Cruz Peace Coalition. And her number is 423-1626, extension 308.
423-1626, extension
308.
Okay, well, we've got a roll. We're out of here. Unless Skidmark wants to do a little singing, a little Christmas caroling, perhaps, Skidmark. He's going to do. He's got to get. He's tuning up.
Yeah.
So listen and thank you. We don't want to forget Becky Johnson, the Christmas caroler of the year, who's composed numerous carols.
Not to mention some heavy hopscotching.
Yeah, and some questionable treasonous hopscotching behavior. We'll talk about that in the next show. And thank you for calling in, Becky.
Yeah, hopscotch into the new year, everybody.
No. Alrighty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Win this war.
Yeah, we don't want nobody telling us what to do. We don't want nobody pushing us around.
The interest of our nation and the interest of our nation in this supplemental is to win this war.
And that's what we're going to do.
Well, win, baby. Let's go.
We're going to have a good time.
Do it. I told our country and I told the world. If it feels good, do it. Terror. Good. Mass murder. Good. Rape. If it feels good, do it.
Begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Message for the people of Iraq. Go home and die. Go home and die. Go home and die.